Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll go in a moment to Lebanon and speak with Habib Bitar, who is a print and broadcast journalist who has covered issues in the Arab world for the leading organizations such as Al Jazeera and Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper and the Beirut-based satellite channel Future Television. He has covered a range of political events across the Middle East, and including the Iraq War and, of course, the recent turmoil in Lebanon. And we'll be getting an update on Lebanon on the eve of a ceasefire between Hezbollah and Israel. And we'll then go to Jerusalem and speak with Daniel Levy, who's the Director of Policy and International Efforts at Hashkem, the Israeli headquarters of the joint non-governmental Israeli-Palestinian Geneva Initiative. Levy was a member of the Israeli delegation to the Taba Summit with the Palestinians in January of 2001 and was on the negotiating team of the Oslo II Agreement from May to September 1995 under Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. He's also now the director of the Middle East Initiative and a senior fellow at the New American Foundation and the Century Foundation. And he has an op-ed piece published in Haaretz, the leading Israeli newspaper, ending the neoconservative nightmare. So we'll get a sense of political recriminations that are already flying in and about Israel, where there's a sense that the Israeli government has blown it in terms of their war objectives in Lebanon. We'll also go to London and speak with Omar Warish, who's an independent journalist and undergraduate college student who lives in London. He has written and commented on the community of Muslim youth from which those accused of the London bus bombings and the alleged plot to bomb airliners this last week emerged. So we'll get a sense from Omar about what makes these young people in the Muslim diaspora want to blow up aeroplanes and themselves. I'm now speaking with Habib Bitar, who is in Lebanon. He's a print and broadcast journalist. He's worked for Al Jazeera, the Lebanon's Daily Star, and the Beirut-based satellite channel Future Television. And of course, he's been very busy lately in as his country's been bombed. What's the latest then, Habib Bitar, in terms of the ceasefire is expected sometime 5 a.m., I guess, Greenwich time. What time will that be in local time on Monday?
It's about 8 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning.
And will it really be a ceasefire? Does anybody expect?
Well, it sure doesn't look like it right now. I mean, Beirut is being bombed. Today there have been strikes all day long from sea and from air. About 11 buildings were taken out earlier this afternoon. Bombing is going on right now, so I can't give you an estimate of how many more buildings are being taken out. 50 villages were attacked today, according to Reuters. A number of Lebanese casualties, about 20 or so. It's really tough to envision a ceasefire at this moment in time because it's a war zone still.
And how much of the buffer between the Blue Line and the Latani River do you think Israel will have occupied by the time the 8 a.m. Monday deadline?
It's really hard to tell you what's going on down there because everybody has their own reports. I mean, Hezbollah claims to have taken out many Israeli tanks, helicopter yesterday, and it's really some fierce fighting going on down there, so it's really unpredictable what's going on.
There has been, though, apparently a fairly marked decrease in the number of Katyusha rockets fired into Israel.
Last I checked, it was in the high hundreds, 150 or so, so I mean, it's still pretty persistent, I would say, and they haven't ended yet.
And what's the sense in Lebanon of whether, I mean, I'm trying to understand the logic of collective punishment here in terms of the idea that Israel went after Hezbollah and in doing so they attacked the infrastructure of Lebanon as a way of turning the Lebanese people against Hezbollah. So where does that stand?
Well, I mean, we do hear a lot in the mainstream media about Hezbollah targets and Hezbollah strongholds, but actually what has been targeted in Lebanon mainly has been civilian infrastructure and civilian residential buildings. This country has literally been broken and strangled. There are no supplies. Food is running out. Gasoline is not coming in. Every school in the country is hosting refugees right now. Every classroom is hosting children sleeping on the floor. There's already some word of diseases. This is a very dirty, unclean situation. I mean, the whole Lebanese coastline has been targeted. There is no more beach tourism in Lebanon. There's a massive oil streak across the whole coastline. Electricity is running low. If we don't get fuel, if we don't get these ships to unload gasoline and diesel fuel for our power plants, in the next week or so, hospitals will not be able to continue running. And that's pretty tragic. I mean, in Lebanon's whole 15-year civil war, the hospitals did not face this disaster. Economically, if the fighting does end, Lebanon faces such a tremendous economic disaster. It's really hard to even speak about it or condense it over the phone in a short interview. No news organization in the world right now has enough reporters to visit every single Lebanese village that's been pulverized, or to visit all the thousands of people who have been homeless, and literally their homes have been destroyed, not just homeless for the time being. In the United States, you know, we always compare things to September 11th. This is a September 11th on a massive, massive scale for a tiny country like Lebanon. Lebanon depends on the rest of the world. It's a small country to trade. All of that has come to a halt. There's no jobs are running low. Companies, business is frozen. People aren't getting their salaries. So this is really a tremendous disaster. We've just started to see it beyond the actual physical pounding. There's a much bigger opportunity cost and a long-term cost for the economy and the people, and the tensions as well. There is fear, as you said, of civil strife in Lebanon. Tensions are running very high right now. This war, there's a feeling it has not really accomplished much. The warring parties are still ready to fight each other. And many Lebanese now are, as I said, homeless and feeling hungry, and conditions are worsening. The siege is worsening. So there could be a possibility of civil strife, and that is really the main fear in Lebanon. If Israel had intended to create that in order to diminish Hezbollah, well, that could be a really big miscalculation, because Lebanon knows more than anyone else the price of violence. And 15 years of violence in Lebanon never solved anything.
So the notion, Habib Bataa, the notion that Hezbollah within the Lebanese society has been given been its place in Lebanese society. It's earned its place in Lebanese society because it's the group that drove Israel out from their 82 to 2000 occupation. Is it possible then that the reverse will happen now, that the Lebanese people, although at the moment they're angry at the Israelis, will they eventually look upon the Hezbollah as the people who brought the Israelis back in and caused $2.5 billion worth of damage?
Hezbollah is not just an organization or a militia. Hezbollah is a movement of 1 million people. If the Lebanese were to turn against each other, that's one quarter of Lebanon. We'd have a civil war in Lebanon. A civil war in Lebanon, as I just said, is not going to solve anything. We had 15 years of vicious civil war in Lebanon, and absolutely nothing was accomplished. Nobody won that war. If that's what the intention is, that's definitely not going to work. People have really suffered a lot in Lebanon, and they're really tired of suffering, really. I can't really express to you enough how much that scenario is a doomsday scenario for Lebanon.
And I saw an interview with Saad Hariri, the parliamentary leader whose father was assassinated by the Syrians. He said that the country's become a playground over, in a sense, the victims of a surrogate war between the U.S., he implied, between the U.S. backing Israel and Iran backing Hezbollah. Is that a sense that's shared by you?
Well, those are the major powers that are involved, and we often hear about the Iranian-Syrian involvement, but the American involvement is just as strong, even greater. That there is a strong feeling in Lebanon that Lebanon has been a battlefield for the Arab-Israeli conflict, and it has been the most punishing battlefield for the Lebanese people. This has gone on, I guess you can go all the way back to 48 and the refugee crisis. Lebanon has 400,000 Palestinian refugees. Lebanon has really been a key battleground in the Arab-Israeli conflict.
But as Hariri's sense was that enough already. We want this kind of this the foreign agenda out of our land. Mm-hmm. Is that a pervasive sense that there's any way that is this Lebanon's historical fate to be the playground of other powers?
Obviously, we would hope not. I mean, even people in Hezbollah claim that they are fighting for Lebanon, and there actually is argument that they can make toward land that's still being occupied, toward prisoners that are still being held by Israel. We're not hearing much about the Lebanese prisoners in Israel. We're hearing a lot more about the Israeli prisoners in Lebanon, but it works both ways. So as long as Hezbollah has a reason to be, it's very hard to imagine them disappearing.
And what's your sense of how much they've been punished and diminished?
Oh, I don't think very much. I think that they are probably one of the least affected in this war. As I said, the Lebanese civilian infrastructure, the Lebanese economy, the Lebanese people have really paid the price. The Israelis and the IDF and Hezbollah seem ready to continue fighting for a very long time to come.
And in terms of the $2.5 billion reconstruction bill that's being sort of talked about now, Hariri had close connections to the Saudis, and a lot of Saudi money went into the reconstruction of Lebanon after the long civil war. Is that likely to be the same scenario repeated, that Saudi money will fix the Christian and the Sunni areas, and that presumably Iranian money will then have to be spent on the Hezbollah areas?
Well, we know it's not going to be very much American money. I mean, Condoleezza Rice pledged boosting Lebanon's USAID budget from $30 million to $100 million, which is really nothing. It's a drop in the bucket compared to $2 billion just 2 hours away from here in a country that's not destroyed. There is talk of Saudis investing in Lebanon, but at the same time, I would say the $2 billion figure is really just a rough estimate. We have not gotten the ground and seen the damage and the opportunity cost. This summer was going to be Lebanon's greatest tourism year ever. Lebanon, as I said, tourism industry is based on a skiing and beach logic, and the whole beach aspect is gone now. The entire coastline is just covered in this oil that was spilled all over the sea from the Israeli attacks on the oil drums that were on the coastline. So the opportunity cost of the Lebanese tourism industry is massive. We can't even calculate that right now. And there's also a fear, I think, of an investment as well in Lebanon and the stability in Lebanon, because, as I said, this war has not solved anything, but shown that the intense fighting that could go on in Lebanon once again.
And is there a dimension here? There was a front page article in the LA Times this week about water being an issue here, in perhaps a motive on the part of Israel. That when the was the apparently the IDF the Air Force have been hitting a lot of these pumping stations that irrigate from the Litani River, and that the Wazani Dam that was inaugurated in 2002. Prompted Israel to threaten military action because it diverted water from the Israeli border that feeds into the Jordan River. So is there any sense in Lebanon that there's a subtext to the occupation of this buffer zone?
Yeah, that's a very strong sentiment here. I mean, this is not the first time that Israelis and Lebanese fight over water. There are other springs in the south that have caused conflicts in the past. Israel has been known to take Lebanese water, as it does from the Jordan River, taking most of the water from the Jordanian people. So there is a big water crisis in the Middle East that could happen in a number of years, and people do fear that the next war could be fought over water. The Litani River is an excellent source of water. Lebanon is a very water-rich country. It's an anomaly in the Middle East, almost. Lebanon is full of rivers and lakes. And Israel definitely, I mean, strategically, would be keen on getting access to that water as well.
But that would mean that the Israelis would have to withdraw after they secured this buffer, and then that this international force of 15,000, largely French, and a matching number of the Lebanese army, would come in. And only when Israel is assured that the area is secured will they withdraw. So what do you expect? In other words, if water is a motive, would they therefore not withdraw?
It's impossible to get inside their minds. Anything really is possible. One of the major problems with the coverage in America is that assuming really the best of Israel and the worst of Hezbollah, when actually both sides are capable of doing anything and having any kind of plans in the region. I mean, it does make perfect sense that Israel would want to secure some water from Lebanon. They have done so in the past. It wouldn't be surprising if they did in the future.
Well, but there's also a much better way to go, which is that the Israelis have offered to sell power in exchange for water. So, I mean, if you had peace on that board, it could be a win-win situation.
Sure. I mean, then again, I mean, I think that it's a bit early to talk about that.
Sure.
It's so uncertain what's going to happen even tomorrow morning.
But in terms of
Israel and Lebanon is pretty far off at this point, I would say.
But in terms of win-win, so far you've told me that Hezbollah hasn't really lost, and in terms of hearts and minds, the Lebanese people aren't angry at them. Perhaps they'll maybe in time that they'll hold them responsible, but at this point they're not. And I understand that the Syrians, the so-called Cedar Revolution drove them out after the assassination of Hariri, they have been welcoming Lebanese refugees and feeding them and housing them. So it looks as if Syria has actually, in terms of the hearts and minds, done pretty well out of this deal.
Well, Lebanese society remains divided. I mean, over that point, really, there are a lot of anti-Syrian elements in Lebanese society. I don't think this recent conflict has really changed, has really made any, I guess you could call it, swing opinions. There really haven't been any. I mean, Lebanese have pretty much stuck to their opinions. Every development reinforces their position. So Lebanon remains divided. I wouldn't go so far as say that this conflict has actually changed support for either way, either Hezbollah or Syria. As I said, it is a pretty strong base Hezbollah has, and over 1 million people. That is really a major part of Lebanese society. So that's an issue on its own.
Well, just in closing, is it possible that Lebanon can go back to a stable kind of multicultural country? Because that was its anomaly in that part of the world was how, you know, obviously Hezbollah is a theocratic party that wants theocratic rule, but they appear to be at least willing to live side by side with their secular neighbors. So do you think that arrangement is broken, or can it be resumed?
I think that the disarmament of Hezbollah will only happen if its reasons for being are eliminated, and that is mainly the Shabaa farms, the number of Lebanese prisoners in Israel. If these issues are taken care of, then we shouldn't really have any need for a fight with Israel any longer.
Well, what happened with 1559, that part of 1559, the UN resolution that came after the assassination of Hariri and the eviction of the Syrians? The impression is that everybody took a pass on the notion of disarming Hezbollah.
That was part of the resolution. I mean, there was definitely disagreement about that in Lebanese society. And of course, Hezbollah disagreed with that resolution.
But they've signed on to this. They've signed on to this UN resolution. So, does that mean that they're actually going to put themselves out of business in terms of a military power?
As I said, it's hard to say at this point. I mean, the only way that might happen is actually if these issues, outstanding issues, are settled. Doesn't seem like America is putting a big priority on that, though, or the United Nations, for that matter.
Well, we'll have to get back to you then, obviously, Habib Bataa, and check in later. I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Habib Bataa, who's a broadcast and print journalist who reports for Al Jazeera, the Lebanon Daily Star newspaper, and the Beirut-based satellite channel Future Television. And he was talking to us from Lebanon. I'm now speaking with Daniel Levy, who is in Israel. He's the director of policy and international efforts at Hashkem, the Israeli headquarters of the joint non-governmental Israeli-Palestinian Geneva initiative. He also was a member of the Israeli delegation to the Taba summit with the Palestinians in January of 2001, and on the negotiating team of the Oslo II agreement from May to September 1995 under Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. He is now a director of Middle East Initiative and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the Century Foundation, and he has an op-ed recently published in Haaretz, Ending the Neoconservative Nightmare. And Daniel Levy, I understand from the Israeli press that I've been following that recriminations are already flying in Israel in terms of what I guess is a growing perception that the government has blown it in terms of the military objectives. And when in Israel, when a government blames the military and the military blames the politicians, the military usually wins, don't they?
Let's say there's a very, very healthy and open democratic debate going on here. I would say that, and it's an important point, I think, to make to your audience. When the IDF undertakes a large military operation, it's a very big decision. The weekend newspapers were full of, would it be more courageous for Prime Minister Olmert to say yes and go for the ground offensive, or would it in fact have been more courageous for him to have told the military, hold your horses? And people have to understand that this is a people's army. So everyone here knows a friend, a relative, a co-worker, a neighbor who has been called up or who is serving and is one of those 30,000 troops who've entered Lebanon. And we have the incredibly sad news, and of course every death is sad. People may be familiar with Israel's leading author, David Grossman, and he lost his son last night in Lebanon. So I say that because there is a difference here. The elite, the politicians, the media, everyone has someone they are close to in this, so it's a very big decision.
But in terms of the recriminations, there apparently is already indications that in the press at least, that the politicians are blaming the military and the military are blaming the politicians for overreaching and not achieving the objectives of destroying Hezbollah, which were the stated objectives initially.
Well, I think there were many people here who were more sober with their initial stated objectives and said that one can hit the Hezbollah militarily, but you're not going to destroy them militarily. If people remember in the 80s when Israel entered Lebanon and tried to kick the PLO out of Lebanon, one of the byproducts, unintended consequences of that was the establishment of the Hezbollah. Now, you could argue that the PLO was a foreign body in Lebanon, Palestinian organization in Lebanon. You could kick them out. The Shiites are not a foreign body in Lebanon. So I think people understood that whatever military achievement was or was not going to occur as an outcome of this, you would need a diplomatic political angle. You would need a diplomatic political solution afterwards. It's going to play itself out in the next weeks. It will play itself out politically. It will play itself out, was the military prepared? There's a lot of questions about our logistics. There are a lot of questions about the people in the north of Israel, 1 million people who've been either left the north, who've been living in shelters. Were they prepared? So this will play out as the big issue in Israel over the next months. And I'm not sure whether it will automatically play out in favor of the generals this time. By the way, many people will say that it's better that we discovered now the capacities of the Hezbollah. It's better that we discovered now that our army, and I think this is one of the points that will ultimately be made, the Israeli army had got used to what are essentially policing duties in the Palestinian territories that we're simply not used to, not planning for, not training for, not investing our resources in. The serious, strategic, difficult military threats that Israel faces and might face in the future when we're bogged down on the Palestinian side. I hope that for some people that may lead to renewed effort to say, hey, shouldn't we finish the Palestinian issue? By finish, I mean reach a negotiated agreement with them, because that's not where the strategic threat's coming from.
But Israel's, at least on the Israeli right, the idea of dealing with the Palestinians unilaterally and putting up a wall, that's going to be a hard sell now because of missiles, right? That a wall doesn't protect you against What's lobbed over the wall, right?
Many of us would say amen. Many of us thought that the wall and unilateralism was a bad idea anyway in dealing with the Palestinians. I think this unilateralist notion, this unilateralist paradigm that is popular apparently where I am and where you are, is getting us nowhere. And so while you're right that the more vocal criticism previously and today will be from the right in saying, well, that means we can't do anything, there is just as vocal, if less heard perhaps, criticism from the left saying, exactly, unilateralism doesn't work. What we've got to go back to is negotiating with the people who are our enemies. And people will, I think, very accurately point out, Israel has a peace treaty with Egypt and a peace treaty with Jordan. Those are not the most warm peace arrangements in the world, but those are quiet borders. We left Lebanon unilaterally, we left Gaza unilaterally, and we can see the results. Let's go back to peacemaking.
And in terms of the, you were saying there are analogies between over there and here. In terms of the Iraq war, many people have argued that President Bush's impetuous and immature use of power in an unnecessary war of his own making has in fact destroyed America's deterrent power and undermined the world's greatest military and to some extent turned it into a paper tiger because he put our boys and girls in harm's way without any real understanding of the situation and certainly no exit plan or not even any coherent objectives except vague things like spreading democracy. So is there an analogy here with these neophyte leaders in Israel who aren't, after all, generals like Sharon and Barak and Rabin? Have they used Israel's military power impetuously, and has it undermined Israel's deterrent power? Because, after all, Israel was, you know, seen as an almost invincible army in that part of the world.
Well, I mean, I think that here one should understand that because of the nature of Israeli society and Israeli democracy, we wash our dirty laundry in public, and we live in a transparent world. So you're all going to be reading about those debates. In reality, every loss is terrible. This will be the war with the least losses in Israel's history. We lost more in the first week of the Lebanon war in 1982 than, and again, every loss is a tragedy, but than we've lost in the just over a month of this conflagration. There'll be many people also who say that while it was justified to Israel to respond to the unprovoked aggression of the Hezbollah, did we respond in a smart way? I think it would be going a little too far, though, to say that this has dramatically eroded Israel's so-called deterrent capacity. But again, it depends how narrowly you define your deterrent capacity. I think Israel has in many ways eroded that by abandoning certain of the peacemaking efforts we did in the past, because I think you have to build strong allies among your neighboring states. Now, I also point out that hopefully we're going to be in a ceasefire place tomorrow, although it's not going to be simple, and we're going to be out of there very soon. So there are some analogies I draw with Iraq, but it seems like at the end of the day, we're going to be out of there. I can talk from the perspective of an Israeli patriot. Americans are going to have to ask themselves the questions of what has served American interests. But you're right. When I look at it, I see when I look at the American situation, I see that an unfinished job in Afghanistan, which is where the threat came from, Al Qaeda being hosted by the Taliban, a war that really had nothing to do with the war on terror in Iraq, in which one is still stuck, in which Iraq has now become a breeding ground for terror, the strengthening of Iran as a result of both of those things, where you almost now have a bipolar Middle East in terms of powers with the strengthening of Iran. From an Israeli perspective, none of that's good. That spreading of instability off the back of something that may have sounded good in some think tanks and in some academic towers, this idea of transforming the Middle East through a simplistic mixture of ballots and bombs, the destabilizing influence, the way that strengthened hardliners, emaciated moderates, that certainly not helped Israel. Again, you will have to decide whether that's been a smart way of securing America and American interests.
But Daniel Levy, you made that argument in your op-ed piece in Haaretz, ending the neoconservative nightmare, in the sense that you're saying that that the people who brought us brought the Americans Iraq are also perhaps leading Israel astray in terms of the Lebanon, and now we have an article that's just coming out in the New Yorker here by Seymour Hersh, who's been saying for the longest time that the neoconservatives have been pushing for a war with Iran, that they, the neoconservatives, and he specifically names Elliot Abrams and Dick Cheney, basically foisted this war or urged the, goaded, if you will, the Israelis into this war because they thought it was a test run for the United States later against Iran. And, I mean, talk about ending the neoconservative nightmare. It sounds like the neoconservative nightmare is just beginning again, or in effect, nobody's put a stake through the heart of this already discredited movement.
Again, I agree with you, and I think Israel can have a role in that. I think Israelis can try and have a moderating, cautionary influence. Ultimately, it's a very, very important alliance, the alliance between Israel and the U.S. for Israel, and it will be the American side that decides whether to continue that policy or not. I wouldn't go too far in the proxy war analogy. First of all, I would confirm that there were certainly no signs throughout most of this conflict of there being an American steadying hand. Pull back, let's move to diplomacy. Diplomacy was pursued only very late in the day. And what many people have written about and noted and leaked, and I can tell you that from my own conversations with senior Israelis, I've had this confirmed, that there were American heavy hints from certain people. By the way, I think there's somewhat of a debate inside the administration. But there were hints from some people, if you expand this operation to Syria, we won't be too upset. So, yes, there was that element. Hezbollah is not, it's too simple to see Hezbollah as just an Iranian proxy armed by Iran, put there by Iran. Some even argue that the timing was not good for Iran. Undoubtedly, from an intelligence defense perspective, we've learned certain things about some of the Iranian training and the Iranian weaponry. I think for Israel, it would make much more sense, by the way, and especially as we move hopefully to a ceasefire and try and stabilize the situation, to explore whether it's not possible to take Syria out of the Iranian orbit. This isn't a given, the Syrian-Iranian alliance. And I think the notion that really has taken root, apparently, in a large part of the administration, that somehow talking to someone is a prize, rather than talking to someone being a way of putting things on the table and trying to thrash out and understand and prod and explore whether one can build new alliances, break alliances that harm us. This idea that it's a prize to talk to someone like the Syrians, I hope, will ultimately be moved away from, and maybe I'm being over-optimistic, yesterday at the UN is a return of diplomacy. The bottom line for me is this vision that some have of the beginnings, the birth pangs of a new Middle East, and it's going to, it's almost a war of civilizations and good and evil. Ultimately, 130,000 approximately American troops in Iraq will come home sometime or another. The 6.8 million Israelis are going to stay here. And for me, the idea that it somehow serves Israel to volunteer to place ourselves in the front line of a war of civilizations, of some kind of Armageddon, which some people, of course, also entertain that notion.
Yeah, Pat Robertson's been over there visiting with Olmert.
Well, some people have short memories. This is the same Pat Robertson that said that the sickness of Ariel Sharon, when he had the stroke and is now clearly, you know, close to death, was his punishment for leaving Gaza. I think this alliance is crazy. Why on earth it's an Israeli interest to volunteer to be on that front line? American can walk away. We can't. Israel has to do everything to stabilize this region. And some people will say, you know what, isn't it better that if they're like that, if there are these crazies, that we're having them exposed and that they're out there? And now we know what we've got to deal with.
But Daniel, do you believe that as many people do, that if the Palestinian thing's not solved, and now you have a situation where the Netanyahu's of the world are going to be saying, I told you so, you can't make a deal. In other words, it seems to me that as long as that thing festers, and with this growing instability in this region, you don't want to end up as a Fort Apache.
Well, absolutely, and this is where the misguided notion, especially now in the face of rockets, that we can put up a wall and it's terrible for Israel to go into that kind of a ghetto mentality. And here's the nub, really. Because what do people say? They say, yes, it's true that the moderates in the region and the forces we'd like to encourage and our allies elsewhere in the world, such as in Europe, say that if you don't deal with the Palestinian issue, you continue to give a fantastic rallying cry to the extremists. You're handing them such a gift if you don't deal with the Palestinian issue. And the automatic response is often, are we supposed to sell our Israeli ally and friend down the river in order to placate them? It's appeasement, if you like. The cry that I think people need to hear from Israel, the message they need to hear from Israel is, hey, this is not against the Israeli interest. No one's doing something bad to Israel by trying to actively pursue Israeli-Palestinian peace. A whole new political party was formed, it's called Kadima, and it's now the leading party of government, on the platform of getting out of the majority of the territories. Whenever you poll Israelis, and Palestinians, by the way, you get a clear majority in favor of a realistic two-state solution, like Geneva Initiative, like the Clinton parameters, like what was negotiated in the past. So no one's doing something terrible to us by saying, hey, let's try and encourage Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. And the story of the last years is a story of missed opportunities. It's what they used to say about Arafat. Maybe today it applies to others. This administration did not take, for instance, the Saudi initiative, where all the Arab states said, make peace will normalize relations with a secure and guaranteed Israel. The death of Arafat and the election of Abu Mazen as the new president, the Israeli willingness to leave territories. Here were all these opportunities, and at no stage was there an attempt to weave them together into a reasonable move towards peace, which would have served Israel's interests. So I agree. I say the lesson now, if we can take something good from this, would be to make a serious effort to return to Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking. I hope it would happen. I think people who understand that we have to reverse this downward spiral of violence in the Middle East will push for it to happen. And what they should hear very clearly is that this is what's best for Israel's future.
Yeah, but Daniel, it seems that we have a kind of graveyard of Americans from this administration that have tried and failed, going back to General Zinni, arguably Colin Powell, and now Condoleezza Rice is being attacked by the neoconservatives over here. Blowing this situation. So it seems that the one person that seems to be more conservative than anybody, except perhaps Netanyahu, is George W. Bush. In terms of an unwillingness to grasp what you've just said, which is that this should be the your main focus, which is to broker a peace.
Look, it's difficult really to say that at any stage this administration swung for the bleachers and has been burned in the process of trying to make Israeli-Palestinian peace. The efforts that were made were very piecemeal. There was never a galvanized effort to say, right, how can we bring you guys back together? I have heard the president talk about the two-state solution. I've heard him talk about the importance of a Palestinian state. I haven't seen that being acted on.
You haven't seen it being acted on, so...
No, what I'm saying is I think it would be wrong to say this administration has tried and been burned.
Right. No, I'm saying that people that apparently have tried have been marginalized. That leads one to believe that the president himself has an extremely hard-line position. And some people worry that it's because of his Christian fundamentalism, that he may well be in the Pat Robertson camp.
He may well be. I just hope that those, let me put it like this, I hope that those in Israel and those who claim to care about Israel and support Israel in America are not in that camp. because that's not a camp that serves Israel's interest. I think the bottom line of this is that what we've seen pursued is a policy that has kind of simplistically taken ballots and bombs as the answer for transforming the Middle East. You know, with the ballots, it's the notion that one needs democracies. Without freedom and democracy, you're not going to be able to confront the scourge of terror. And the bombs is you have to attack the extremists, the terrorists, the purveyors of weapons of mass destruction. All that sounds fine. When you try and counter that, you're told either that you're a cultural imperialist because you don't believe Arabs can do democracy, and or that you're a pacifist because you're not willing to use force when it needs to be used. The answer to that, I would suggest, is democracy and freedom are not about a purple finger every 4 years, or every 1 year, as it seems to be at the moment in Iraq. Anyone who's serious about trying to create the conditions for more open societies has to be investing in creating the context, education, rule of law, accepted rules of the game. And if you think it's just about a vote, you're being simplistic and you're getting it wrong and you're leading to the kind of things we've seen. Now, in terms of how do you win the war against terror, again, yes, there is a role for the military. Undoubtedly, one had to do, and unfortunately, one should have finished the job in Afghanistan. But it doesn't end with that. Yes, you need to cut off their supplies of financing and you need good intelligence. But, and here's the crucial point, either one's going to get it or one's not going to get it. Those who talk about root causes, real injustices, genuine grievances are not soft on terror. They understand a more sophisticated reading of how you defeat terror. If you cannot address the real injustices, then you are going to have more and more people lining up with the extremists, creating conditions for the extremists to flourish. That's bad for Israel. That's bad for America. That gets to the core of the Palestinian issue. Now, if, as you say, there is not an address for that argumentation in the US today, then Israel's job, I would suggest, and other people's jobs, is to limit the damage for the next 2.5 years. But I would also say that we need to continually make that argument, because I'm not willing yet to write off the next 2.5 years.
And just in closing, Daniel Levy, what specifically do you think you can do in terms of reviving the peace movement in Israel? Of course, the peace movement was all but invisible in this last war compared to, say, in 82, when there were massive demonstrations. And clearly the Israeli people were behind the intervention into Lebanon. And there's apparently a genuine feeling in Israel that when the head of Iran says, "We want you to wipe you off the face of the earth," that he means it. So in that environment, how do you revive the notion that, again, nothing's going to work out until you go back to the basics, which is make a deal with the Palestinians and end this agony?
Well, I think, first of all, it's understandable that there is concern and confusion in Israel when our closest ally is telling us, you know, don't talk, you have to see this through to the end, when we're hearing the genuinely horrible, disturbing utterances coming out of Iran, and when there's an unprovoked aggression from an area that we actually withdrew from, which is South Lebanon. So one can understand that. One can understand the hunker-down mentality. There was a tipping point, by the way, in the last days. The mainstream peace movements, the mainstream center-left parties, and Israel's kind of cultural figures of authority came out against the expanded operation. But I think all that is, it's understandable that that's how people feel, but I don't think it changes the basics here. And I think you still have a majority of Israelis who understand that ultimately this is going to end by talking, not shooting, and shooting has to be a build-up to securing a political deal. I think the vast majority of Israelis still don't want to be in the territories. I think Israelis are confused. I think, by the way, that the real concern here is Iran, and that's why again, what do we do with Iran? Do we continue policies that apparently have been strengthening the Iranians over the last years, or do we begin to say that either one has to, as people like Kissinger have suggested, go for a grand bargain with Iran, put everything on the table, which I think will be very difficult, although I wouldn't totally rule out. Or do we have to conduct ourselves in a way that begins to take the cards away from Iran, and that weakens the Iranian hardliners. And, of course, the Iranian regime is not monolithic either. And
well, a step in that direction would be bribing the Syrians back into the fold, right?
Get the Syrians out of the Iranian orbit.
Right.
Take away the Palestinian card by going back to serious peacemaking with the Palestinians. From the American perspective, coming up with a serious plan for Iraq. So there are things that we can do. You don't sit around folded arms and do nothing vis-a-vis the Iranians. And just righteous indignation is not a policy. Dealing with Syria, dealing with the Palestinians, looking at how one extricates oneself from the Iraqi situation, those would all be sensible suggestions that go alongside threats and that would go alongside sanctions. The question is, do we still remember how to do diplomacy?
Well, on that note, I'll leave that one hanging, Daniel Levy. I thank you very much for joining us from Israel.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Daniel Levy, who's the Director of Policy and International Efforts at Hashkem, the Israeli headquarters for the joint non-governmental Israeli-Palestinian Geneva Initiative. He was a member of the Israeli delegation at the Taba Summit with the Palestinians in January of 2001 and on the negotiating team of the Oslo II Agreement under Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. He's the author of an op-ed recently published in Haaretz, Ending the Neoconservative Nightmare. I'm now speaking to Omar Waric, who is an independent journalist and undergraduate college student who lives in London. He has written and commented on the community of Muslim youth from which those accused of the London bus bombings and the alleged plot to bomb airliners, which emerged this last week, came from. Omar, just in terms of the general overview, there was a survey done apparently recently, a survey of 1,000 Muslim Britons conducted by Channel 4 Television that found out that 45% believe that the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the U.S. were a U.S.-Israeli conspiracy, while 20% thought they weren't and the rest were undecided. Fewer than half said they thought of Britain as my country, and 30% said that they wanted to live under Islamic law. What's your sense of that survey?
Well, I think that survey needs to be attended to with a slight tincture of skepticism. As you said, it was 1,000 people polled. That is the equivalent of 0.0005% of the British Muslim population, or people who may be considered British Muslims in this country. But I think there are trends to be discerned there that exist within the British Muslim population, and there's been considerable alienation, not just now, but for several years. Britain has known... it's been known that in Britain there have been a series of reports issued talking about institutional racism in places like the Metropolitan Police, the Crown Prosecution Service, and other areas in not 7th July 2005, but 7th July 2001. Riots broke out in the northern town of Bradford, where there's a significant Asian population, predominantly Pakistani, where the far right, an organization called the National Front, who are effectively fascists, attacked the city, were marching into the city, and Asian youth took to the streets with intent to defend the neighborhoods against that intrusion. What happened in the end was there were battles with police for several hours, and many of the people who were on the streets were meted out some of the most severe sentences known in the British penal system. There is very, very little representation of British Muslims in the media or in other centres of power. For example, in Parliament, there are only four British Muslim MPs. It's disputable to what extent their views actually line up with the rest of the population, given that their voting records tend to align with Blair's. There's only one Muslim columnist in the entire readable press. I'm not talking about the tabloids, although their position is markedly weaker. So there's been very little engagement on this way. There's been much talk of young Muslims, but there has been nothing approaching an honest and exhaustive exchange of ideas.
And what about the footage that we've seen some time back, obviously before the July 7th of last year's attacks? But they were over here in the media and on television. You saw interviews with the young groups of young British Muslims and hanging around the Finsbury Park Mosque, spouting off, saying that democracy is corrupt and it's thing of the past, and jihad is the future, and you know, pretty much sort of Bin Laden light type of rhetoric. Is that Is that reflective of any serious percentage of the population?
Oh, well, these people are fringe fanatics. They're not cases, they're ghastly people, but they exist in a very strong, small minority. I mean, they weren't around. If you looked at the Muslim population and people who were asked to talk to after the 7/7 bombings, there was an overwhelming opposition to those actions, and those actions were thoroughly condemned by people of Muslim extraction in this country. The problem is that those people are on television more than ordinary British Muslims are, so there's this gulf, that this chasm of understanding that has developed. When people talk about young British Muslims, they aren't open to hearing ordinary voices. What you tend to see is these fringe fanatics dancing around, spouting their vile rhetoric. Or you get the videos from suicide bombers afterwards, after they've died. That rankles ordinary Muslims. But you're right in saying that that there is a threat. We know there's a threat. The suicide bombings happened. British Muslims are involved in acts of terror, ghastly acts of terror in Israel and in other parts of the world as well before. And these things need to be confronted and attended to.
And are they likely to be? I mean, it seems like you've got a kind of xenophobic racism on one side and denial on the other.
The denial is a problem. It is a problem. In a way, it's not the problem I think some people make out. I mean, the denial shows these people that the Muslim population is not keen on terrorism, that they abhor it thoroughly. But in the other sense, the denial stops them from understanding or tackling those elements that may exist in those communities. And this needs to be, but that can only be done if there's an open engagement with these people, and they're not constantly, you see the standard format of an interview, and you must have seen this over the last few days, is the aggressive line of questioning. Will you condemn this? Will you apologize for your co-religionists? Will you do that? When these people are ordinary civilians who, in terms of their worldview, like the majority of Britons, are irreconcilably opposed to war and terrorism.
And how much do you think the external stuff that's going on influences it? I mean, there are a lot of non-Muslims, even in this country, who are passionately angry at the Bush administration.
Absolutely.
For what they see as a disastrous misapplication of American power and the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis weighs on their conscience. So give us a sense of the external. I mean, in other words, it sort of goes back to the question about Israel. Is that if you solve the Israeli-Palestinian question, the theory is that a lot of the anger goes away. So how much is the broader landscape of the Middle East affecting the passions of the young Muslims?
Well, it's the predominant concern. Like I said, there are other factors at play: socioeconomic conditions, racism, this sort of social exclusion that takes place, but Middle East foreign policy matters. You might be familiar with the name Robin Cook, who was the former Foreign Secretary of Britain. Now, he wrote, poor man died last year, but before, when the issue of the Iraq War came up, he wrote, "The way to tackle terrorism is not to make war in Iraq, but peace in Palestine." And I think that has a tremendous resonance. Now, it's the war on terrorism as launch was meant to combat terror. From any plain discerning of reality shows that it has not done that. In fact, the invasion of Iraq has triggered noxious and awful forms of terrorism in that country, and it's come to Europe as well in the form of the Madrid bombings and the London bombings.
But what about the fact that most of these people that have been scooped up in this latest plot, and I believe the previous subway bombings as well, are of Pakistani descent, as are you and your family, and that Pakistan, of course, is next to Afghanistan, and it's the front line on the war on terror. And there appears to be, a certain ambivalence going on there in terms of at least accusations that Musharraf is not doing enough. And he, on the other hand, I think feels that he's on a between a rock and a hard place, if you will. So again, I'm trying to get a sense of how much Pakistan's internal situation is reflected in the diaspora.
Well, it's interesting, but it's also surprising in some ways because lots of young people of Pakistani descent here don't have much of a connection with Pakistan. They're not familiar with its culture. They're not familiar with its language. They may travel occasionally there to see their family, but not very much. But you seem to be right that there is evidence that there are people who have been traveling there to sign up for training camps and all sorts of other ghastly activities. And that they seem to be able to do that because of their connection with Pakistan. But that's not the only case. I mean, Arabs have done that as well from the Arab world, from different parts of the world. Different Muslims from all over have been there. There's evidence of Chechens being there and Bosnians being there and so on. It's that area, because it is that no man's land sort of area where there is no authority, there is no policing, there is no control being enforced, it's a very, very safe place for terrorists to be and to foment their, to hatch their plans.
So there's not a real cultural connection in the sense that your feeling is that those that have emigrated to England don't really have much of a sentimental connection to the homeland, or it's certainly not a.
Well, they haven't immigrated to England; they were born here.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no sense that the radicalism there is in any way being exported. Except in these rare cases where people go back. I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of, again, what the proportionality is here, you know.
The proportionality in terms of what, sorry?
In terms of numbers.
These are marginal, very few cases, as we know. I mean, you're talking about, at most, scores of people, which is a very, very small number as compared with the rest of the population, as compared alone with young people of Pakistani origin.
Well, I thank you very much. I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us from London, Omar Warish.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, Amy and Masters. Just speaking then with Omar Warish, who's an independent journalist and undergraduate college student who lives in London, and he has written and commented on the community of Muslim youth from which those accused of the London bus bombing and the airliner plot have emerged. This program is produced by Lewis Vandenberg. I thank Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coo, the assistant producer, and Jazz Shepherd, the engineer.